In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. I'm Hans Delinier, and...
Oh, no, wait. Even in my deepest voice, I sound like a pathetic five-year-old girl compared to you, Hans. Anyway, I'm back. I think I missed more episodes in a row than Rick.
That hurt.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I can remember what to do. Anyway...
Man, when you first came on, I thought you were like Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Yes.
Darth Poulton.
That's right. Anyway, so we've got a full house today anyway. So I'm going to go with you, Rick, first because... You're kind of top left on my Skype screen. What's up, buddy?
Oh, hey, guys. I'm busy. Oh, so busy. But hanging in there, trying to make it through, trying to make up my mind if I want to buy a pair of virtual reality glasses. They're kind of cool. They're only $6.99. It's like cheaper than a Google Glass, and it does a lot more. So I was just looking at that. Literally, I got this email. I don't even know how to say it. Lolo. But basically, these things are pretty cool. I'm looking at stuff. Playing a lot with vSphere 6, about ready to pull just a little bit of hair I have left out. But other than that, things are good.
Yo, what do you mean they look pretty cool, as in from a tech perspective? Because to look at, they look ridiculous.
But they look more like a glass, like sunglasses. Google Glass looks different. First of all, you can see the subject's eyes. You can't see the subject's eyes in these things. So in a sense, there's this, like, you don't have to look at people looking at you thing. That's why I think they're cool.
But everybody would be looking at you.
Everyone's always looking at me, man. What would be diff? Come
when
on.
When you're handsome like you, that's what happens, isn't it? Anyway, right. We better move on because we're talking about consumer tech, and Hans is going to come down on me like I don't know what if we talk about consumer tech. So... Next up, Gabriel. Hey, well, where's the background noise?
There shouldn't be. Well, I mean, like I said, I'm technology golem today. I'm in a cave.
Yeah, you're at OpenStack Summit, right?
Yes, I am. I'm here in Vancouver, which is actually wonderful. It's like 65 degrees, sunny, beautiful. The conference is amazing because they put the solutions exposition or the expo space in this giant room. It's all glass facing the bay, and you just have this awesome, amazing view and a lot of great activity and a lot of great people. So it's been a very fun and busy week, and I've really been enjoying myself.
Oh, I was just going to say, Vancouver is the jewel of North America. It's underrated, but unless you've been to Vancouver and seen it and experienced it, it is an amazingly beautiful city. Love it.
Now, it's probably on my top five cities in the world that I've been to in terms of, like, I love this place. I was talking with Kenneth Way from EMC yesterday, and he was kind of giving me some of the backstory on how Vancouver came to be what it is today. And I, you know, I've always reflected on this, like, Vancouver is like the clean version of Hong Kong. And there's a lot of similarities between those two cities with a lot of Asian people who came over from Hong Kong during the run-up to it folding back over to the Chinese. So there's a lot of that influence here.
How much of it do you get to see at a conference like OpenStack Summit, though?
Well, you know, I lived up here for about 6 months off and on between 1999 and 2001 when I was doing a bunch of work for an early or for a now failed .com company. So I've seen a lot of Vancouver over the years. But at the summit, you can see a pretty good function of the downtown area. Right out in front of us here, there's this, you know, this little bay area, and there are all of these seaplanes that, you know, for like $80, you can take a seaplane ride around Vancouver, go out to BC, British Columbia, and come back and see the whole city and the whole area. So a bunch of us are going to probably do that tomorrow.
That does sound awesome. Anyway, Hans, the engine room of the podcast. Can I just call for a round of applause for Hans?
Hey now, Jesus. My man, yeah.
Hans, you are the engine room in the podcast. You do all of the back-end arranging, the Slack channels, the agendas, the lot. You've ran the show while I've been off skiving. What's going on with you, buddy?
Well, actually, it's not a secret that's my most productive thing of the week. And it's not a secret as well that I've been looking for a new challenge. And actually, this week has been... rare week of really good conversations. So it's motivating.
Good luck on that front, mate, because it is ridiculous, your situation at the moment. You know, you are one of the guys that puts in the most effort into anything that he does. And, man, something is going to come good for you soon.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound patronizing with that. I genuinely do mean your situation is ridiculous.
Well, we'll get over it, and we're still having fun here, right, every week.
Yeah, we are. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. I'm channeling you, though. I'm just channeling you, Nigel. I am so blasted good. I'm great.
Give over.
Hey, so I bought about $150 worth of beer supplies today. That's how good I am. And it's just simple stuff like siphoning equipment and buckets and spigots and all that stuff.
You are living the dream right there.
Yeah, yes, I am.
It sounds like you're going to become the Heisenberg of beer manufacturing.
I'm trying to. If there was a way that I could get speed in there, you know, and make it blue, I would.
Why blue?
Well, that was the color of Heisenberg's speed in Breaking Bad.
Oh, of course.
I thought you were already thinking about blue pills.
Now, that would work, too.
Yeah, I would say take those before you go on the airplane ride.
Cool. Well, you know what? We've got nothing to follow up on from last week's show. So shall we move on into the tech news from this week? We've only really got three things on the agenda so far. So we've got Simplivity announcing KVM support and OpenStack support. Then we've got Zerto loses a patent argument with EMC and they're told to cough up. Am I right? Is that just $500,000?
Yes, as a fine.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
And then EMC, oh dear, offering cash rebates to the channel. Check it out, right? And I'm sure this kind of stuff goes on all the time. But if they stop selling competitor products, really, I don't like the sound of that.
No.
Should we go with the Simplivity plus KVM plus OpenStack stuff first?
Every Simplivity installation up till today has been on ESXi. One of the key things that is on Simplivity is that they actually require a vCenter to be deployed. Adding the move to KVM was expected, and I think Hyper-V later on this year. The only thing that I'm still questioning, and I'm sure they're going to answer it in the short term, is where's the management layer in this? Because KVM as such is just the hypervisor, right? And it's been one of my gripes at all the KVM supporting hyperconverged solution is, well, where's your vCenter? What's your virtual machine management layer? Where's your high availability? So that has not been disclosed yet, and I'm really looking forward to what they've chosen there as a solution. Other than that, looking forward to how they changed the being dependent on vSphere for their deployment model.
Hey, Gabriel, before you come in with your thoughts on this, right, and because you've been at Simplivity before, I don't know, do you have any kind of rough idea as to what kind of slice of the pie when you're selling, what do they call them? Is it OmniCubes they have at Simplivity?
It's an OmniCube, right? That's the unit of sale, the appliance, if you will.
Right. And it being packaged with ESXi and vCenter and stuff like that, any ideas on how much of the pie they're handing over to VMware every time they sell one of those OmniCubes?
You know, all right, so the thing is, they do not, you know, when I was there, we did not sell the license for VMware. You brought your own license to the table. So, and I don't believe that any of the hyperconverged solutions actually packaged the license for the hypervisor included, except for EvoRail. And so, you know, there are licensings and royalties in terms of being able to package the hypervisor with a deliverable. And I believe that you have to pay something towards to VMware for that. It's kind of like a licensing structure. But I don't think we never included costs for vCenter or VMware, Essentials Plus, or whatever licensing model you were going to leverage going forward. We made the distinction that, you know, certain functionality was tied to VMware and the level of licensing you were utilizing, like VAI and whatnot. But outside of that, it was, you know, bring your own vCenter.
I'm just trying to put my finger on what the driving factor behind this is. because I think a lot of the talk is that it's around cost and being able to pull some of the cost out of it for some customers.
Yep.
Well, yeah, that and too, and anybody who wants to leverage OpenStack and have a little richer integration. I mean, you know.
So are OpenStack customers like the Android customers? They don't like paying for anything.
Well, you also can do more things. If you go down OpenStack, and then if you have, you know, the hypervisor with KVM, and then like a broad scale out cube in the case of the SimpliVity OmniCube, you can also basically introduce like an object store, right? You can't do that with vCenter today, but you can with OpenStack. And that might be helpful with a Swift object store in your own data center, so you actually get some different functionality.
Well, I believe you can with VMware integrated OpenStack, right? That solution is basically just it's VMDKs running on whatever target you want to place them on. In that instance, you are exposing, essentially you're exposing the management and flexibility afforded with VMware in terms of HA, DRS, vMotion, those type of technologies that aren't inherently baked into the KVM stack for the hypervisor. On Hyper-V, like I personally, I think this is probably more of a ploy towards an OpenStack integration deliverable, and I think that was something that was also mentioned in the press release. I found it interesting that they released a press release about OpenStack and KVM integration, but they have zero presence here at OpenStack 7. Though I have seen a few engineers that I knew from here. So,
I've checked their contributions from SimpliVity to OpenStack, which is 30% of their contributions is on Cinder. 65% of their contribution is on Nova, and that has started since April last year, but only with, I think, about 59-60 commits, which is not that much, and from one engineer. So it's not that they have a whole team working in OpenStack, but they have done a couple of commits. And you'd see a consistent work since April last year.
To me, this sounds like it's far more opportunistic than strategic. They probably have a couple of large accounts that they're selling to. And, one of them said, hey, how about this KVM? That's what we've standardized on. It's what we're going to use. It's a lot cheaper than VMware. So if you're going to get in here and work with us, get on KVM. And the other one on OpenStack, too. Some large account probably said, look, if you're going to come in here, and be a vendor to us, you have to work with OpenStack and allow yourself to be managed by OpenStack management processes. That's probably what it was. And now they're making mileage out of it.
I think I disagree. I would disagree on the KVM part is not going to be driven by an existing customer that said, I want this or you're not. KVM part is they feel the heat from a lot of the newer hyperconverged players are all starting on KVM. Most of them started from a storage layer, like a ZFS on Linux layer, and adding KVM. So there's a lot of heat in the hyperconverged market coming from the KVM space, and they cannot ignore that part of the market that will come. If you look at what hyperconvergence in itself means for a customer, it means ease of use. That's the biggest deal, right? We've been talking about that for a couple of times. The ease of use is the selling point here. So for ease of use, you don't need a vCenter because vCenter is quite complex to handle. You want a simple UI. Look at Evo. Evo Rail has a very simple UI, and that's something that doesn't matter which hypervisor is in the background. That easy UI is built in HTML ML5, can easily run on KVM. So the differentiator between KVM and ESXi will be slimmer for a lot of the small customers. I think the KVM part is a strategic part to be able to, if the market shifts to the cheaper licensed version of KVM, that they are able to follow that. The OpenStack part, I do agree that is an opportunistic thing, just making sure not entirely missing the boat.
But neither of us know, Hans.
No, that's true. As well, Hans, how can you fudge ease of use and SimpliVity plus KVM plus OpenStack into the same sentence?
The KVM news and the OpenStack news, for me, are not related at all.
Oh, okay.
No, they're inherently tied together. So let me just chime in here real quick. So A, I almost guarantee you this is probably driven by a couple large customers who want to build private clouds and want to use KVM as the vehicle of compute. There's almost zero. I can't see, you know, for one, there's a couple things. One, OpenStack is not an appliance-based deliverable for the most part. If you look at most people who are building OpenStack clouds, they are taking bits and pieces from others. And the turnkey, simple solution that they're looking for isn't at the infrastructure side, it's at the deployment and management and deliverable side, right? KVM is regulated mostly to large cloud providers and very large enterprise customers that are looking for. It is a... You know, have seriously deep Linux chops and they understand how to manage all of that stuff, like to write their own you know, management and integration and deliverable solutions. And you know, that's the state of the market and the way I see it. If KVM was such the bomb, Scale should be destroying the hyper-converged market if that's what customers really wanted, because they offer a very cost-effective solution, but yet you still do not see them in large-scale deployments, and they've truly tried to regulate themselves to the SMB space, and they do have a very nice management portal that sits on top of their KVM-based solution, right? So, you know, to me, this is part of keeping up with the Kardashians. It's about being able to have the checkbox that says, now we are hypervisor agnostic. We're not tied entirely to VMware. It gives the customer, it's like, oh yeah, look, they're developing, they're moving forward. But strategically, you know, I would hazard a guess that, you know, Nutanix supports KVM, VMware, and Hyper-V. I would say that the distribution of their customer base is probably 90% VMware, 5% Hyper-V, 5% KVM.
But it doesn't have to stay that way. I mean, that's...
It doesn't have to stay that way, but there has to be a compelling reason.
Look at what Veeam has done in the last 4 or 5 years. They added Hyper-V after a couple of years of VMware, and in the beginning, it was merely 5% Hyper-V. I think the percentages went up quite a lot in the last 2 years.
Yeah, but that's a specific use case. Backup is not your entire data center infrastructure, right? So you're trying to capture customers who have diversity of workload in their shops. Customers don't have diversity of hypervisor for the most part. They've chosen something.
You think the 5% going to stay that way?
Well, you invest in what is going to change and be good long term. Honestly, other than, you know, new features, I mean, there's not. You got to make sure that if this other market, KVM in particular, and OpenStack works, you have to make sure that you have what you need to go down that route. So I think it's good timing and a bet on the future and a bet on it working. But, you know, when it comes to adding new platforms, it's very much a calculated decision. And I think, you know, it's honestly good that they're going down this route.
Well, I think all the hyper-converged infrastructure players have to be able to be hypervisor agnostic, because the chattering classes have now stated that the hypervisor is a commodity. So if you're not showing that movement, or at least, you know, a faint toward that direction, at least announcing it, even if it's not delivered for another 6 months or 12 months, you kind of have to show that you're making forward progress.
You know what I love about conversations like this? Gabriel, you're hazarding guesses at stuff like this. Mark, you and Hans are like, yeah, it's this or it's that. But you know what? Neither of us really knows. I'm just staggered each week that anybody actually listens to us, to our opinions. Brilliant.
Put it this way, there's an opinion for everyone.
That's true. Hey, you know what, though? Isn't it official that OpenStack is just... It's just science projects now, though, right? Because Gartner has blessed our opinion of the last 6 months that nobody is... You know, other than those big service providers and what have you, nobody's really doing OpenStack properly for production, right?
I watched the team from Walmart Labs give the presentation at the keynote address. They run their entire Black Friday operation on OpenStack. All of their public-facing web portals for the 11,000, you know, store Walmart machine runs off that. They have deep... I mean, it's 140,000 cores right now, and they showed, I'll find the picture of it, I think, and I'll put it up on the chat, but they showed their OpenStack adoption, which they started working on like in, you know, late 2011 or early 2012, what that infrastructure looked like in a graph chart in terms of the ramp, and you saw that it muddled around there for 6 or 7 to 9 months as part of that science project, and then there is a near linear or a near vertical trajectory in terms of expansion. from that point. Now, obviously, not everybody has, you know, Walmart superpowers money because, you know, they have the time to do this. But there are other customers that look similar in scope to that type of adoption and that type of ramp up to get with it. What you're seeing, in my viewpoint, and we'll probably talk about this next week after the show wraps up, but you're starting to see it become a real viable platform for a certain type of customer that's DevOps focused, but that it's still not, you know, the end all be all for everybody else, right?
Well, that's a magic teaser into next week's show then, Gabriel. Let's leave it at that for now, because I think we spent a fair bit of time on that. Can we talk quickly about EMC offering these cash rebates to the channel then? If they, the way I read it, right, is effectively if they stop selling competitive products in the storage space, then EMC are going to give them more kickbacks, more cash, more training, more marketing funds, more love, right? Now, I'm sure this kind of thing goes on all the time, but just doesn't wash well with
me. I'm sure it doesn't.
Really?
I have never known a single reseller that kicks out all competitors and sells only one vendor. This is ridiculous.
No, but what I'm saying is plenty of resellers have their favorites, and very often that favorite is EMC.
That's different.
And that is not based on anything technical.
There's a big difference between having your favorite vendors than the vendor telling you, you can only sell our stuff.
So my I didn't quite get that from it, because one of the articles I read was saying that if 80% of their storage sales at EMC, then they get these certain kickbacks. And then if 100% is EMC, they get even more kickbacks. Now, fair enough if 100% is EMC. But still, incentivizing a channel partner saying, you know what, if 80% of your storage sales, that's clearly saying you can have other storage companies' products on your sales ledger, right? But as long as you push the vast majority of EMC, then we're going to give you better kickbacks. That kind of thing, I'm fairly certain, happens.
But it's the latter that makes it illegal, at least in Europe.
At the moment.
You know, my thoughts on this is like, A, this is like the only kind of vendor lock-in that I would want to avoid. Put yourself in the shoes of the sales organization, right? So, hey, look, the company makes more points or you get spiffed on selling this product. Guess what product I'm going to push at every opportunity? Because I'm human and I want to make money, I'm going to only push EMC products. So if your vendor line card has five different storage products on it, I would not expect those VARs to drop the other products from the line card. But what I would expect them to do is everybody's going to rush to sell EMC because they're going to get a higher comp on it.
I don't know, Gabriel. I think it takes the price right to the street. And I think this is a program that works for the value less resellers as opposed to those that add value. The value-added resellers are still going to want to sell the right solution. And, you know, there's some gray area there where you could go one way or another, but I think this just ends up, you know, making EMC cheaper, and in the long run, there's less money to be made on EMC, even though you get the money comes back to you in the form of the spiff. And how are they going to audit this anyway? I mean, shoot, I mean, if I'm a reseller, I'm going to give them fake books, whatever it takes, you know.
Yeah, you know what? These are all good points, people. But, you know, it kind of almost feels like, is it like buying a car, you know? Because very rarely does one dealer, right, sell many different types of car. And then the analogy makes sense, because then as me shopping for the car, it's on me, the buyer, to find the right car or to find the right storage or whatever. So, you know, if it happens, great. But hopefully people can, you know, make their own informed decision. And if any ecosystem giant, right, would come in and say, well, hey, partner, reseller, you can only sell this suite of stuff. And then the end user says, oh, okay. Well, that's the problem right there, when they don't question that. So I think that really becomes a takeaway that, the buyer needs to do plenty of their own research. And if they find those value adding resellers, you know, hold on to those, because they're running a business. Those resellers are running a business, and I understand it's basically a coin operated business. There's margin on sales, there's money on services, but you as a buyer, you know their business when you get to know them. Is it only this? Do they hit you with that? You know, you have to sniff it out, and I think that it really becomes just more onto the buyer, believe it or not, than it is onto the reseller for this.
I agree. What does it say, though, about EMC as a company? Does it actually say anything bad about them, or does it just say, you know what, they're doing what any successful business should do and look for every opportunity to push their products to the market?
You know, I think it says a lot about the nature of the storage industry. I've thought for a long time that whatever growth that a company has in the industry comes at the expense of its competitors. And right now, let's face it, NetApp's reeling, right? I think this is an anti-NetApp program that where EMC and NetApp are, you know, are online cards of a lot of resellers, and EMC is trying to push them out, and they feel that they can probably get there right now. And so they don't have to call it the anti-NetApp program, but it is.
So NetApp are on the ground and EMC are putting the boot in.
Yeah.
That would actually be a very fair point, Mark.
Yeah, I like the sound of that too, yeah. I mean, there's never been any love lost between those two guys, has there?
No, and that's their biggest, I think, consistent worldwide competitor by far. So, yeah, that's absolutely spot on.
And you know what? We've given NetApp a hard time on this show of late. Does the storage industry need a strong NetApp to keep EMC in check then?
There's never going to only be one way to do what we're doing. So I think yes.
No, because, I mean, the thing is, there's like HP and there's Dell and there's HDS and there's Pure and people like that. But none of them have really challenged EMC in market share over the years. And I'm not necessarily suggesting NetApp have, although they certainly have in the filer space. But they have consistently been the one big alternative at most of the companies I've worked at, especially in financial services in the UK.
Well, the one big difference, though, is NetApp, actually, I take it to the hill, have the most advanced software stack for those six names of storages that you listed. There are plenty of new storages that do plenty of other things, don't get me wrong. But of those big like household six names, they have by far the most advanced software stack. So I think there's definitely a need for that. And some of the things they do, I think, is very impressive and very good. But, you know, they're having a rough go. We'll talk about that in a second. But I think the industry, the customers, especially the on-prem, non-cloud type, need an alternative to something like EMC as that first choice alternative. And then those other three or four, you know, IBM, Hitachi, Dell, and whoever else, HP, would round out the stack, especially as it applies in different geos. I think we need it.
You know, Rick, to your point earlier about customers being actively involved in this process, right, it brings me back to something where, you know, when I was at 3PAR and we were selling against Symmetrics at 3PAR, right, we would get into deals just because customers would initially bring us in to help drive down the price of whatever was trying to sell them.
Oh, yeah.
That's a classic.
Hey, Rick, that comment about NetApp having the most advanced software stack, mate, I can feel listeners' blood boiling and itching and shouting down their headphones at you. What is
he
talking about?
I'm telling you, consistently all things in of those six big brands. I
think
don't know.
You can have people take you to task on that.
Rick Van over on Twitter, I'm ready for anything, friends. Bring it on.
He's been smoking.
So should we switch on to business news then? We've got a bunch of items on here, and maybe we'll pick off NetApp first, but let me just run through them real quick. So Equity Capital Research started a rumor that Cisco was looking to pick up Nutanix. Having Hans and Gabriel on the show, I think we really want to touch on that in a minute. Other news, though, not great news. NetApp is wielding the axe against some of its employees. We'll definitely talk about that. Drobo's got spun out, or is going to get spun out again. Exablocks performs a C round, bringing in $23 million this time to a total to date of $45 million.
Boho just announced the round C of 30.
Yeah, 30 million. And did that take them to something like 65 million in total, I think? Yeah, it did. Yeah, looking at my notes here. Yeah, so Coho just completed a C round. You're right there, Mark. So they took 30 million this time and now have a total of 65 million. So money's still coming in from the venture capitalists there. But can we talk about NetApp first, right? I know there's at least one layoff that's been kind of close to our hearts. Nick Howell's data center dude has been shown the door at NetApp, really. And I know, Hans, you've got kind of upset about this. I don't know if you want to say anything about it.
I'm furious about it. Furious. We've had this whole discussion on LinkedIn for the last 3 to 4 weeks now about NetApp. And we had a pretty good balanced discussion, actually, from former partners to employees to people from the outside like we are. Very balanced. What's the perception on a company? Where are the gaps? What's happening? One of the things that we have seen is that since Vaughn Stewart left NetApp to go to join Pure Storage, there's been a big gap in public communication. Everyone's seen it, and except for NetApp. NetApp has not seen that and filled that gap with another chief evangelist of that level. Now, what Nick has been doing in the last, let's say, at least more than a year, is slowly building that gap, closing the gap, building out the community, not from the very blast out type of person that Vaughn is, but more from a step by step building the community back. And I think he's done a great job. There's a lot of people, and if you talk to current customers and partners, every single time you hear his name, Nick Howell, data center dude, blah, blah, blah. And NetApp really has an issue with their public perception today. What Rigatron is saying about the software stack, no one out there believes what they're saying about that. No one. But Nick Howell was the only guy that actually was making progression in getting that name back in that public voice again. And then he's like the first guy they axe. This means literally that NetApp is clueless about their public perception in the community.
NetApp hates community. That's my Kanye West moment.
God. I always think of Kanye West when I hear your voice.
No, but in truth of it is like, you know what, there could be any host of weird reasons why they chose to do what they did, right? I mean, it sounds like the RTP team got hit the hardest with about 15% of that group being laid off. You know, I hope that they take care of those people in terms of severance and job help and all that other stuff and benefits. But it's just a nature of when a company the size of NetApp has five years of consistent downward trend on their bottom line and their profitability, things start to go sideways and go wonky. And I think you're starting to see, you know, you're probably going to see the numbers come out, and they're not going to be very good, if not even really like almost horrible. You know, you can already see it in the stock price. Those things fluctuate, but something like this does not give investors a lot of confidence, even though it may shore up balance sheets a little bit.
Didn't they have layoffs last year as well?
I think this is like the third round that they've had in 3 years, yeah.
Yeah. That's not good.
No, they're on a downward spiral. I mean, they are going through a rough patch. But I agree, Gabriel, you know, I hope that Nick and the other guys that are laid off there get a golden handshake on the way out the door. But I tell you what I really believe. That, well, when you look at Vaughn Stewart, right, I know the circumstances were different. He chose to go to Pure. I guarantee he has never looked back since then. And somebody like Nick is going to land on his feet. I mean, Gabriel, I probably don't even need you to answer this, but I bet you've just moved to SolidFire, right? I bet you there was not enough money in the world that would have dragged you over to NetApp in that kind of a role. There's so many better... There are so many better opportunities out there for Nick.
You tie seven figures to it and you do a lot of cool things, right? But, you know, I mean, the reality is it's with Nick, he's data center dude. He's not NetApp dude.
Absolutely.
Right? And so I think that that's the point that I would want to drive home is, like, Nick has a broad and deep set of talents around not just storage but data center and virtualization technologies. I count Nick as a good friend. I think that he's going to be just fine. He's going to land on his feet someplace else. And I tend to look at it, this is as optimistic as Gabe can get, is, you know what, things happen for a reason, and usually you're better off when something like that occurs. It may suck in the very beginning, but you know what, it's an opportunity to go out, you know, take your time, take a look back, have some good discussions with a lot of different companies, and kind of take stock of what you want to do, and then maybe you find the actual job that you're meant to do, and maybe you end up working for the kind of people who really can appreciate the kind of effort you're putting into it, because it's obvious that NetApp did not.
Yeah, onwards and upwards for Nick, I reckon.
Yeah, go get him, Nick.
Now then, shall we just switch gears slightly then? So I mentioned Equity Capital Research, and I don't know whether are you just allowed to do this, but they started a rumor last week that Cisco is looking to pick up Nutanix. And before we get into the meat of that, actually, you know, as an analyst in the financial sector, I guess, are you just allowed to do that? Just sheer scandalous speculation, or was there more to it than that?
I don't know. It could almost be criminal activity. It's the kind of, no, I'm serious. I am really serious.
Yeah, we're talking about a public company, Cisco.
Yeah.
Yeah, this kind of wishful thinking really makes you wonder about the integrity of the analyst that did this, and whether the trading groups inside the company, the analyst and the traders, are in cahoots or trying to do something here. That's really, you know, are they tied into hedge funds making deals, or what the hell is going on? I mean, it smells like illegal activity to me, period.
I agree.
There you go.
Yeah, not impressed.
So I wouldn't necessarily say immediately illegal activity. I think that they would have to disclose if they held any position in Cisco, because that's obviously the only thing that they could disclose, is that they have shares of a public company, or if they held any position in Nutanix in terms of investment. Those would have to be disclosures that were made, and if they're not, and it came out that they were, then obviously, you know, you have some kind of stock manipulation, insider trading. I mean, we've seen this half a dozen times with all kinds of other things. Outside of that, if I speak about the analysis that was taking place, it was fairly obvious to me, and pretty much anybody who understands the space, that this person had no technical knowledge whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He was relying on discussions with a few people. He was relying on past merger acquisition activity and the fact that there's a gap, kind of, with what Cisco has today. I mean, this was pure conjecture, and it was really bad. And I was surprised. Well, I'm not surprised that CRM picked up and repeated it, because all they do is repeat gossip. But, you know, the Register took it and went with it as well. I wrote a blog post the morning that that article came out. I read it. I'm like, oh my God, this person is borderline mental. And you know what? Let's take a look at it from the technical viewpoint and the type of work it would take to integrate the Nutanix platform into the Cisco environment today, and from the point of view of what Cisco needs. And, you know, that post got like 3,000 page views in 24 hours, which is, you know, a lot for me, because I don't think anybody reads what I have to say, but it was like an amazing uptick in traffic. And then, you know, I got a lot of good feedback from people saying, yeah, that's really good analysis. And it didn't seem like anybody else who wrote about it actually sat down to kind of analyze what would be the limitation in bringing something like that over, right? Because if you look at the entirety of the UCS message, it's stateless computing. That's not hyperconverged. And even inside Cisco, they have like 10 different products that they could pitch potentially as a hyperconverged solution to fit specific use cases. They have partnerships with Simplicity where they could go out tomorrow and turnkey or OEM that solution and sell it as their own and capture the revenue. They could do the same thing with Maxta. They could do the same thing with GridStore. They can do the same thing with Store Magic and half a dozen other products that are out there. And if you look at it from that point of view, it's like, yeah, there's a gap there, but there's a gap only from the term of Cisco capturing all of the revenue of a hyperconverged sale. They do have offerings that they can go to market with. Buying Nutanix at an inflated price point, because you know they're going to want $3 billion, it is kind of crazy. And you know what? I'll put my tinfoil hat on here and say that somebody who had a vested interest in a Nutanix IPO or an increased Nutanix valuation floats a rumor like this in order to get buzz and pump up the valuation, and they attach a specific dollar amount to it because that's what they're targeting. You know, I have no full disclosure, I have no information about any of that stuff. That's pure conjecture, and that's me putting my crazy hat on.
I like that story better than mine. I think that's really astute. And the fact that you work both at Simplicity, you know, a competitor Nutanix, and at Cisco recently, it gives you a very interesting perspective. So I'll put my money on that.
And it was a good write-up, Gabriel. So any listeners, go to gabrielchapman.com. It's up there. Very well worth the read at the moment. Hey, Mark, I did have a couple of questions for you around just in general this kind of activity, right? So, because you've been at companies that have been bought out several times in the past, right? In fact, actually, you were at Equalogic when they got bought, yeah?
Yeah, Equalogic, 3PAR, and StorSimple.
But weren't Equalogic looking at IPOing around about the same time as well?
Yes.
So that was, I guess, the crux of my question, right? If you're an employee there and you've got stock in the company and what have you, and you're potentially looking to IPO, when there starts to be talk about being acquired by another company, what kind of things start going through your mind there? Is there a difference for you as an employee and as a stockholder between an IPO and between an acquisition, or does it really depend on how either of the two would go?
Well, it kind of breaks your heart. You know, there's the IPO is a very exciting thing, and it's always very forward looking. And, you know, you hope that you can make it and you hope that the IPO goes well. But you're thinking about the years that follow, too. And you're thinking that, well, if everything works out, you know, there will be more stock options, you know, in the future and more, you know, career growth and a growing company and all of this stuff. And you're just thinking growth, 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 growth. When you get acquired by another company, you are tied like a rusty boat anchor to that company and where it is going. And immediately it becomes less about growth and all about politics and how am I going to swim with the sharks at this new place and all that. At least that's the way my head works.
How fast can you run away?
So look, there's the good news and bad news. The good news is this company is going to pay what for our stock? Yeah. That's great, right? And it is the end of the road for that, right? And you can choose to stick around through the end of that. You know, usually you have to continue to vest for the period that your vesting would be at the old company. But you know, sometimes you just think, you know what, I'm done with this. You know, like I left Microsoft last August, right? So it's a mixed bag. I think in every case you'd rather see an IPO. It's higher risk. You understand why people do it. I mean, Don Bulins is a very good friend of mine, and he was the CEO at Equalogic. And the amount of money that was paid by Dell to acquire Equalogic was a lot of money. And you can't really, you know, the responsibility is to give the shareholders, and you know, those are the VCs and everything. Here's your exit. We've got this exit potential. Do you want to take it? Right. And when it's a lot of money, it's probably going to go that way, even though I think that if Equalogic had stayed independently, it would have quadrupled whatever the money paid out to everybody that was involved.
Mm-hmm. But if you have the check in front of you, it's really balancing out, is the IPO still going to be worth it, taking the risk of an IPO? Because every IPO is still a risk, right? You have to
absolutely.
You have to trust in the market to follow what your intentions were. And not every IPO is equally successful.
All kinds of things can go wrong. You know, many, many things can go wrong. Key people can get hit by trucks, have heart attacks. New competitors can come in. You know, lawsuits can happen. All kinds of things can go wrong. There's a sea of risk out there. I mean, you can take that big check and cash it. There's a real good reason for doing it.
Sunlight is a great disinfectant when it comes to the IPO. And sunlight on the books and what companies are doing to gather sales and how much they're spending and how much true revenue is inside there is even bigger value of what's going to go forward. So you look at companies that IPO in this space, and if they're paying $12 to get 50 cents of revenue, how sustainable is that long term?
Yeah.
That wasn't going on at Equalogic, by the way.
That wasn't. But you look at some of the recent storage IPOs, right? So Nimble, Fusion.io, Violin. Look at those three. Two of those companies are really not viable anymore, and one is, you know, doing okay.
Not great, but okay.
Hey, you know, when it comes to IPO versus acquisition, who really makes that decision? Does the CEO have a lot of say in that, or is it the board and the investors?
It's the board. The CEO and the board, they really do.
The CEO stocks the board, right? Depending on how powerful and how much influence he has an ability to kind of have a little bit of aspect on deciding who goes on the board. But more likely, it's the VCs themselves that are making sure that their interests are being protected, and they are putting people on the board, if not themselves individually. Yeah. So I say the CEO probably has 15% of say in terms of, you know, or it depends on how the voting rights are set up and based on shares and some of those other things. But, you know, I think the VCs or the people who have the financial, true financial interest are the ones that are more likely to shape that decision-making process than the CEO themselves.
Yeah, but Dheeraj answered, so Dheeraj answered that call publicly this week. His answer was, well, we have a gentleman's agreement with Dell. If we would want to have an acquisition conversation, the conversation would be first with Dell themselves and then maybe with anyone else. But one of his points was, if the board wants to sell the company and I want to go IPO, they probably are not going to sell it because you don't want to sell Nutanix without Dheeraj in the first place.
You know what? A gentleman's agreement has about as much binding power as, you know, my opinion. I mean, I, you know, strong CEOs are definitely a positive, right? They launch the company, they can focus the direction, they can set the course of the culture of the organization. But necessarily, are they necessary to the further success for the company that purchased them? No. Almost every CEO leaves after a year. Right? Every CEO founder that, I mean, the good vast majority of them I know that have come through with acquisitions, what, are they all still there? Right? Is anybody from 3PAR, from the, you know, the founding team still at HP? You know, Whiptail,
yes,
but, with Cisco? At,
yes,
you know,
but not for long.
Which was my entire point, Gabriel, is that Dheeraj really wants to bring the company public in an IPO. So it means that he wants to go beyond that IPO, remaining a CEO and not just selling the company. It's not his intention to sell the company.
His exit strategy isn't to cash out. Yeah. I mean, it, that's the way to read it.
So that's why the acquisition as such, if the investors or the board decides to make an acquisition against his will, it would not be really the smartest decision at all.
Well, it definitely doesn't make it an easy or simple transition, does it?
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think the path of least resistance to an exit is, hey, let's all go along to get along and let's work together as a team.
Yeah.
Unless there was some massive, you know, weirdness and fraud or something crazy like that, I would not expect the board to not vote in the same interest that the CEO and the founding team has got going on.
And it's very interesting that Dheeraj singled out Dell. I mean, it's that might be kind of nice, but he's a smart guy, and he knows that Dell can't afford him. They can't.
D stands for dead.
Yeah, and they certainly can't compete with a Cisco. There's no doubt about that.
In terms of raw cash and capital ability, no. But then again, keep in mind, Cisco's money is parked overseas. That's why they would do a debt issuance if they were to purchase anything. So watch the financial wires. That would be a bigger tip off to me than anything else. And I've not seen any massive debt issuance on Cisco's part in the tune of $3 billion, have you? So there's your answer.
All right, let's switch on to maybe one final topic then. Mark, I think you want to say something around Coho's C round of funding, yeah? Where they've netted another like $30 million, is it?
Yeah, another $30 million. I think what's interesting is looking at the investors that were reported in this round. March Capital, I don't know about March. I don't know if they let it. Intel. Mm-hmm. Intel has been fairly successful in storage. HP, a very interesting investor. And Andreessen Horowitz and Ignition. And it's an interesting group, and the fact that HP is in there makes me wonder if HP may be trying to position for a play to acquire Coho at some point.
God, that sounds like a train wreck to me. Oh,
I get where you're coming from, but wouldn't that be like too obvious?
I don't think HP has a way to make investments these days. And Tom Joyce, somebody that I know and I like, and I worked with Tom for a short period of time at HP after the 3PAR acquisition. I think HP makes all strategic all strategic investments pretty much, right? And so I think HP sees this as a strategic play, and they get to go along with, you know, their good partner, Intel, and, you know, the other guys are VCs, but... Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting move that HP is in this.
I know. It's a rare move because I haven't seen that many HP investments. You talk about a lot, but I haven't seen that many where I see HP popping up as one of the investors in a round.
Look at it this way too, though. Just because you see HP doesn't mean that it's HP, the enterprise computing arm. I haven't dug into this, but you know, like Intel has an investments arm, Cisco has an investment arm. A lot of these larger organizations have an investment team that does analysis and looks at the offerings to make investments in order to make money on the cash they have sitting on hand. I don't want to just have $50 billion in cash parked making 0% interest. I want to do some investments in order to shore up balance sheets and do those types of things and get a return on the money that I have at my disposal that I'm not reinvesting into the company itself. So, I mean, that's always one thing to look at. You know, Intel has a very, very strong investment team. I believe Cisco does as well. I know GE Capital. I mean, there's a lot of organizations out there that have these kind of investment teams that go out and buy stuff all the time. I think it's interesting there's, what, six investors for $30 million? Not a lot of cash. I mean, look, it was one investor, or maybe two for the SimpliVity's $175 million round. And one of those turned $150 million. I'm more interested in the dollar amounts attached to each one of those institutions.
No, that's very true. It's not a lot of money, but I think to counter your point, Gabriel, HP doesn't make a lot of investments, right? You haven't seen that much coming out of them. And Tom, who is an enterprise guy, Tom Joyce, who is an enterprise guy, he is thickly involved in their decisions to make investments. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. As far as the amount of money, I agree. You'll see, you know, you look at what Cumulo did, or Data Gravity did, and I know about an announcement that's coming next week, but a company that's, you know, just, you know, it's basically an A round that's going to be more than that. So the $30 million is not a huge amount, and it'll be interesting to see what Co is able to do with it. Although, you know, you think $30 million, it's a lot of money. Mm.
So in your opinion, Mark, watch this space with regards to Coho and HP then, yeah?
Yes.
I'm just staggered. $30 million for a company that, in my opinion, they've got cool technology going on, but they've got any customers? And have they even got like a single straight story yet? I don't know.
Well, don't you think that's why it might be a good fit for HP?
Oh, definitely. There you go.
But I'm changing.
And on that, shall we wrap up the show? I think it's been a great show, guys. Thanks for being on. I really, really appreciate your opinions and your thoughts. And thanks to everybody for listening too as well. And you know what, guys? I've been away for like 3 weeks. Thanks for having me back, man. I've missed it. It's been really good fun.
We missed you, and it's great having you back.
Oh, cheers. Thanks. And listeners, don't forget to check us out on LinkedIn and Twitter and all that kind of jazz as well. Until next week.